Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. In this episode, I speak with Inner Circle co-coach Susan Niebergall, and we do a big Q&A. We've gotten a great response to the last couple of those that we've done. So in this episode, we do a big Q&A answering a lot of common questions specifically pertaining to strength training. Hope you enjoy the episode. If you have any questions, please let me know. Let's get into it. What's going on, Susan?
What's going on, Jordan?
How's everything? You feeling good?
I'm feeling great. Yeah, doing good.
You got into New York 2 days ago, right?
2 days ago. Got in on Friday and leaving tomorrow.
And we're finishing up the December 2020 edition of the Inner Circle. Yeah. This is the 5 year anniversary of the Inner Circle edition.
That's something else. That's
super amazing. Excited about it.
Super excited about this.
So, for everyone who doesn't know who you are, which at this point it would be crazy, would you just want to tell them a little bit about you and where they can find you?
Yeah. So the name is Susan Niebergall. Some people think it's Susanny for some reason, but it's really not. That still comes around, but it's Susan Niebergall. And I own Susan Niebergall Fitness, and I am a co-coach with Jordan in the Inner Circle. And yeah, I'm out on Instagram a lot, on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, and I have a podcast as well called the Strong and Lean at Any Age podcast, and you'll find Jordan and I on that podcast as well.
So I love it.
Everywhere.
I love it. So in case this is your first time listening, Susan and I do a lot of podcasts together, and one thing we started doing several months ago is we do Q&A podcasts. So once or twice a month, we'll go on Instagram, we'll get a Q&A going, and then take a bunch of the best questions from there and answer them in podcast form. And that's what we're going to do right now.
We love doing that.
We just went over a bunch of the questions that we got, and we're actually really excited because usually our content is very nutrition and fat loss focused, but today we got a lot of questions specifically around strength training, and there are some nutrition and fat loss questions in there, but there's a lot on strength training. So we're really excited to go over that because as amazing as fat loss is and as incredible as it is and as much misinformation as there is, I still really love talking about strength training. Yeah, so, and we got some really good questions this time. So let's start off with sort of a mix between the two, both in terms of nutrition and strength training and fat loss and muscle gain. Someone asked, fasted weight training and losing muscle. And that's all they said. And I guess what they're trying to get at is, does fasted weight training cause you to lose muscle? What do you think about that, Susan? Yeah,
I think this whole fasted thing, whether it's weight training or cardio, has been kind of this myth. And from the strength training side, a bad myth, and from maybe the cardio side, it's really good, you know, it burns extra or whatever, you know, and it's a myth, really. I think people have to weight train when they can based on schedule. Some people do it early in the morning. No, you won't lose muscle because you're training with not a lot of fuel or any fuel on board. When you're going to lose muscle is when you're not keeping your protein up to help support what you're doing. You know, getting your nutrition in through the course of the day is what's ultimately important, not having it right as you work out, you
Correct.
Know? I mean, I think you might feel a little different if you have some food on board or whatever. That's a different situation, but you're not going to lose muscle.
Yeah, I think what's important to remember here is not only is schedule important in this, some people, they're only able to get their workout in at 4 or 5 in the morning, but also preference. Like some people prefer to work out either having eaten beforehand, or some people prefer not to have much food in their stomach. And I think there's so many myths. I think you brought up a good point in that for fat loss, a lot of people feel like fasted cardio is the ultimate for whatever reason. And for muscle gain, a lot of times people will say fasted stuff is the most evil thing you can do. It's the most detrimental thing. You're going to lose your muscle. That's not how the body works, right? Our bodies are very advanced. If we were so radically affected by something as simple as training fasted, that like we wouldn't have survived to where we are now. It's just not how the body works. Yeah. If we would lose muscle simply because we exercised without food in our stomach, then we wouldn't survive. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just not, we wouldn't be able to get here. So training fasted does not cause you to lose muscle. What would cause you to lose muscle is if you're not strength training at all and or if your protein intake on the day isn't sufficient. Yeah. So more than worrying about the minutiae around whether or not you're training fasted, figure out, okay, how much protein do I need every day? And how many times a week do I need to be strength training? And I would say from a protein perspective, 1 gram per pound of your lean body mass, 1 gram per pound of your goal body weight, if you want to use that option. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of strength training, I would say at least 2 to 3 times a week, mm-hmm. and you'll be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, next question, Susan. Can you be in a calorie deficit and grow your glutes at the same time?
I get asked this all the time.
All the time.
And I'm just going to say this. I'm 60 years old, and for the first time in my life, I have glutes, okay?
Your glutes are really coming through lately, seriously.
Right? So, and when that changed is when I got into a small surplus and have been maintaining since. Mm-hmm. So can you... I suppose, but I would think the frustration level will be so significant because you won't see the changes that you want to see. And I think, you know, people only want to put on shape to their glutes and no fat anywhere else, you know? And so that's what drives that question, I'm convinced, yes. Right? Everyone just wants the glutes and nothing else. And it just doesn't work that way. And here's the thing, if you eat to support your goals and then... maybe you put on a little bit of extra fat here and there. You know, you can always turn back the clock a little bit and go into a small little deficit and start chipping away at that a little bit. But I think it's way more optimal to feed yourself. Get in maintenance at the very least. I think a small surplus, and I mean small, I wasn't in a big surplus at all, is optimal. And then hammer them.
Yeah.
Yeah, really hammer them.
I think to answer the question, can you? Yes, you can. You could also ask the question of, like, if you have two people in a fight, one of them with a gun, one of them with a knife, can the person with the knife win the fight? Yeah, they can, but it's not going to be an yeah. optimal situation, yeah. right? The person with the gun is a huge advantage. I think that's really what happens here is when you have a calorie surplus, again, doesn't mean eat as much as you possibly can and gain a ton of body fat, but even a slight calorie surplus gives you a more optimal situation to grow any mm-hmm. muscle, not just your glutes.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, this is an important point to consider too. I think that for you, your glutes were harder for you to grow relative to something like your shoulders, mm-hmm. right? Like your shoulders are just like out of this world, right? And if you haven't seen Susan's shoulders, go to her Instagram, go to her YouTube, like holy shit, her shoulders and arms are insane. And I think in the same way, a lot of people ask, well, how do I lose body fat from my face? Or how do I lose body fat from my stomach? Or how do I lose body fat from my hips? You don't choose where you lose body fat. It's genetics, right? And your body will choose, as long as you're in a calorie deficit, in what order and where you lose body fat from. Same thing with muscle. Some people will, just based on their genetics, they'll add muscle really well to their upper body and not so well to their lower body. Mm-hmm. Other people, they'll have legs like tree trunks, but it's much harder for them to grow muscle in their upper body. So I think for you, what happened is you sort of maxed out, we'll call it, your genetic potential to grow your glutes in a deficit, mm-hmm. right? And then once you went into a surplus and you optimized your nutrition, well now, boom, your glutes are popping like yeah. crazy. But this is where it's like, I think, yes, you can do it, but if you really want to optimize it, it's going to come down to making sure you're in at least maintenance, if not slight calorie surplus.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and it'll be so much less frustrating too, just overall, because I think you will be able to see visible progress maybe a little bit quicker than if you're in a deficit and you're like, is this even working? And I mean, mm-hmm. go through all that.
All right, next question. This will be a really good one. How do I get stronger at push-ups? I struggle even with knee push-ups.
You know, and this is a common question we both get, and we're both big advocates of elevating your hands.
Yes.
And we were just on a live with the Inner Circle where somebody told us that they started with their hands on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
And that made our day, because that's where we want you to start. Elevate your hands so your hands are on a wall, and then you're in like the regular push-up position. You can practice being in that position with your hands on the wall. You can practice big range of motion. You can practice bracing your abs and getting your elbows in the right spot on the wall. And then maybe go to a countertop, because the countertop is a little bit lower. And then maybe after the countertop, you go to a table and you start working your way down to the floor. And we love that, because you have definite signs of progress mm-hmm. with how strong you're getting. You're getting stronger. Every time you can go to the next step lower, you've gotten stronger.
Yeah.
And then as you get closer to the floor, it becomes a lot harder because you're moving more of your body weight the closer you get to the floor. But starting at the wall and working your way down is a great way to do it.
Yeah, I think an easy way to conceptualize this, like, is imagine you're doing them on a Smith machine. Like, if I'm at the gym, it's mm-hmm. one of the things I really like to have people on. The Smith machine is the machine where the bar is on sort of this track and you can lower it down one peg at a time. So start off with it as high as you need it to go. Mm-hmm. Maybe the bar is literally right in front of your nose yeah. and it has to be that high. Mm-hmm. Or realistically, it probably wouldn't be that high. Maybe your chin or your right. shoulders. But if you need to put your hands on the wall and do a push-up, that's where you can do it. Where you, yep. if you're doing three sets of five and you need to have your hands on the wall in order to make sure you're using a full range of motion, then do that. Then go down to the countertop, then go to the table, then go to the couch, then go down to the floor and make sure you're getting all your reps in there. Susan, what would you say, aside from just doing that type of progression, what else can someone do? Let's say someone, they're at the point where they can do push-ups with their hands slightly elevated, maybe onto a couch or a bench, and they're right on the verge of being able to do one push-up, but they can't do one real push-up from the floor yet. What would you have them do?
Probably do a slow eccentric or slow lowering to the floor or to the couch or wherever you are. And then just get yourself back up and reposition and do it. So eccentric emphasis, you're just emphasizing the lowering portion because that's the hardest part, really. And I've had people literally go all the way down to the floor where they're laying on the floor and come up, you know, almost from there. So, but I love the lowering part of the push-up, focusing on that, because I think if you can get strong with that, you're going to be miles ahead. It's tough. And I would tell people this too. I think a lot of people go down to the floor too fast. I yep. mean, just from the motion perspective, there's no control. They kind of plop yes. down, right?
Yep.
So learning to do that with control is what's going to really build up strength, because your muscles are under tension longer. And so you're going to build up strength more that way. So mastering that in general, I think, is a great way to go.
Yeah, I completely agree. What a lot of people forget is that we are stronger eccentrically than we are concentrically. And what I mean by that is, imagine, let's say I just put a barbell on your back, right? I put a barbell on your back, a super, super heavy barbell. You could take that barbell and lower it under control, but you might not be able to stand back up with it, right? And the standing back up would be concentric. That's the concentric movement. In the same way, a push-up, right? If you're in a push-up position, you might be able to lower yourself to the ground under control, but getting back up, the concentric part of the push-up, you might not be able to actually overcome that yet. So we are stronger eccentrically than we are concentrically. What's really cool about this is we can use this to our advantage. And what Susan's saying is you can lower yourself to the ground under control. So even if you can't do the concentric portion, maybe you do five reps of only the eccentric, only the lowering portion. You get in the top position of a push-up, you stay at the very top, and you take 5 full seconds to lower yourself all the way to the ground. Your instinct is going to be to try and drop down and plop, especially maybe you'll be really slow for the first 2, 3, 4 inches. But then as your chest gets closer and closer to the ground, you're just like, drop down, and your chest will hit the floor. That's not what you want. You want to imagine there's like a thumbtack on the ground. And obviously you don't want to just drive your chest through the thumbtack. You want to land, you want to go very, very softly, barely touch it. And then if you're only doing the eccentric part, you get on your knees and you bring yourself back up to the top position without doing the full push-up. What I've always found is, and this is held true with men and with women, regardless of age, regardless of training experience, if you can do 5 eccentric only push-ups and each rep takes 5 full seconds, you can do at least 1 regular push-up. Yeah. And again, so that use this as a tester. If you can do 5 repetitions of an eccentric only push-up, you don't have to get back up. You just only lower yourself down under control for 5 full seconds per rep. You can do at least 1 full regular push-up.
I would agree.
So that's how I would work towards it.
Absolutely. And just one more thing on that. I would caution anybody who's starting on the wall, not to like jump down to the floor right away. People tend to skip over progressions on
this.
That's
a good point.
And then they get to the floor and they get frustrated because they're not there yet. You've missed the three quarters of the progression to get there. You know, it takes time and just a little bit of consistent effort, and you'll get there.
Well, that's actually a good point that I sort of want to talk about, sort of the mental side of all of this, right? Because the there's one side of strength training, which is the physical, but also the mental side. Mm-hmm. And this is so overlooked. And this is what we were talking about in the Inner Circle Live, because the woman who brought this up, she was saying she started doing push-ups on the wall, mm-hmm. and then she slowly and slowly progressed down and down and down, and now she's doing regular push-ups. Mm-hmm. And the cool part about this is a lot of people, they might do push-ups on the wall the first time, maybe even the second time. Then they'll open Instagram or they'll go over to their friend's house and they'll see someone else doing push-ups from the ground, and they'll get so discouraged that they aren't where that person is. Like, yeah. Well, that person is so much stronger than me. And then they'll just stop trying. They're yeah. just like, well, I quit. Like, that person's stronger than me. Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
You, number one, you can't compare your chapter one to someone else's chapter 15. Number two is, if you're just going to quit simply because you're not where someone else is, like, that's a very poor life strategy. Yeah. And if you just stay consistent with it, you do the wall pushups, you do that for a month, 2 months, 3 months, however long you need. Then you lower to the countertop, month, 2 months, 3 months. Then you lower to the table. Then you lower to the couch. Then you lower to the floor. Then you do the eccentric only pushups. Then you do maybe a few eccentric only, and then a couple concentric with your knees on the ground. Mm-hmm. Before you know it, you're going to be cranking out real pushups. Yeah. Just like you yep. said, you've got to be consistent with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, next question. So this is going away from strength training for a minute. Susan, how can you get over hunger when you're in a calorie deficit?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because I think so many people are programmed to go grab something at the first sign of hunger.
Yes.
Like yep. the stomach growls. Guess what? That's kind of normal. You know, it yeah. we're not going to die. I think... It's so funny. I used to carry like a protein bar with me in my purse all the time. I would be out for an hour running errands, but God forbid I didn't have that protein bar in my purse, because like what? I wouldn't have food for an hour. I might feel my stomach growl for an hour, but that's kind of where I was. I thought, oh, my stomach's growling. I need to eat.
Yeah.
You know?
And a lot of people think if you get like that stomach growl, they assume that means muscle loss.
Yeah. Like it's bad.
Yeah. Like it's a bad thing.
Yeah. No, it's actually kind of a good thing. Indication that things are cooking along where they need to be. So if it's that kind of hunger, you need to push through it. You know, we're sitting here drinking seltzer water. That's a good sign. That kind of takes a little edge off
absolutely,
of
yeah.
the hunger, you know, without any calories or anything. So you could do stuff like that. I used to chew gum sometimes. I mean, you can find things that will take an edge off, but you need to experience that. It's not comfortable. So if you're expecting that this is going to be all lollipops and roses, you know, that's not what's going to happen. Now, if that hunger is like you're ravenous like all the time, now that's maybe issue. A different story.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, well, this you bring up a really good point, right? Because anyone who says you're not going to be hungry, like a lot of people will sell their method of fat loss by saying you'll never be hungry, like keto, you'll never eat as much as you want, mm-hmm. but don't have any carbs. And so there, you'll never be hungry because you can have as many like meat and fats, as much of that as you want, but no carbs. And their selling point is you'll never be hungry. Mm-hmm. Paleo, same thing, like eat as much as you want of these natural foods, but nothing processed.
Right.
And their selling point is you're never going to be hungry. The thing about fat loss, the thing about being in a calorie deficit is hunger is normal. It mm-hmm. is expected. You shouldn't be starving. You shouldn't be ravenous. You shouldn't be like, food shouldn't be all you think about. That's a serious issue. That's not what we're talking about. But hunger is normal.
Yes.
And for example, Susan brought up the seltzer drinks we're having right now, which by the way,
yeah, these are
if you haven't tried this,
yes.
it's literally just half seltzer water and half diet cranberry juice. And diet cranberry juice is literally 5 calories for a whole glass. So it's delicious.
It's so good.
It tastes super, super good. And for whatever it's worth, this is something like if I'm going out drinking with friends, I'll just get this. I'll just get like seltzer and cranberry. Number one, like if I don't want to field the questions of why aren't you drinking, bruh? It's just like, this is my way of like, I can look like I'm having a drink and not worry about fielding those annoying questions. But it takes the hunger away, I think largely because of the seltzer, right? Mm-hmm. There are other strategies you can use too, obviously eating more protein. A lot of people ask, why should I eat more protein if I'm trying to lose body fat? Mm-hmm. As though like they're mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you have a higher protein intake, Well, then it's going to help. It's the most satiating of all the macronutrients. So that's one of the main reasons, aside from just the muscle and the strength aspect of it, it keeps you full for longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, also to say that even if you're in a modest deficit and you have these little hunger pangs here and there, and one day maybe you're ravenous one day, because maybe you screwed up your calories that day. You know, you didn't eat enough on the front end or something like that. Lord knows we've all done that. That's okay too. You know, that's just a day. That was just a little mix up, whatever. We're talking ravenous like all the time.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
That's a big problem. And for whatever it's worth, that's why I don't want to be so lean all the time.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why, like, I don't like doing fat loss phases because it's not fun.
No.
It's not something you shouldn't be in a fat loss phase for a year. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be in a calorie deficit for that long. If you are, then you're not in a calorie deficit.
Right.
And it's unless you have a lot of weight to lose. But if you've got 10, 15, 20 pounds to lose and you say you've been in a calorie deficit for a year, you actually haven't been in a calorie deficit for a year, because that would be a problem. Part of being in a calorie deficit is there's hunger associated with it. So as you get out of the calorie deficit, one of the main benefits is, like, your hunger will go down,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, in terms of getting through it, obviously increasing protein intake, making sure you're staying hydrated and drinking. I'm a huge fan of Greek yogurt, low calorie, mm-hmm. high protein, cottage cheese, low calorie, high protein. I love oatmeal. Mm-hmm. Oatmeal is just so filling. Oatmeal for me, it sort of just like sticks to the bones type of a food.
Called rib sticker.
I love that. Yeah.
It's a rib sticker.
It's a rib sticker.
It's a rib sticker.
And the other thing I think, also shakshuka.
Yes.
Shakshuka, and Susan comes over for dinner on Friday night.
It's my favorite.
It's if you haven't looked it up, actually, if you're in the Inner Circle, my recipe for it is in the Inner Circle recipes. There's mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of recipes in there. But if you want, you can just Google shakshuka. It's a low calorie. It's basically, imagine it's just pizza without the crust. Yeah. And you can put some eggs on it, and it's high protein, low calorie, and delicious. That's like my go-to
fat loss meal
yeah. that just tastes ridiculously good.
It is so good.
So yeah, it's not about eliminating hunger. It's more about understanding how much you should be mm-hmm. having. And if you find that you're always hungry, either your calorie deficit is too much, mm-hmm. you're eating way too little, or the foods that you're eating aren't nutritious enough. For example, if you're eating, listen, I love sour strips. I think they're great. But if the majority of my food is sour strips, I'm going to be starving.
Yeah.
Versus if I have one big salad a day with a bunch of protein and I have shakshuka and I have a bowl of oatmeal, I'm going to be stuffed for very few calories. Mm-hmm. So you have to figure out, is the quality of your food the issue, or is maybe your calorie deficit the issue?
And just be okay with being a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's super important. You won't die. And it's not an emergency that we're hungry. You know, it really isn't an emergency. And honestly, if you sit with it and go drink some seltzer or go for a walk or do something when you're feeling like this, you're going to find that it passes.
Yeah.
It does pass. And then you're like, oh, okay. You know, oh, I'm okay. I'm here.
That's exactly right. Yeah. All right. Going back to the strength training questions, this is a good one. What is the benefit of ass to grass squats versus parallel squats? What do you think, Susan?
You know, I'm not an ass to grass kind of person.
Neither am I.
At all. So I would say not much.
I'd say just, there's more risk.
With how my hips have been, yeah, I would totally say there's a lot more risk. And I don't understand the necessity for it. And I think over time, it has gotten to be some sort of standard. Somebody somewhere made it a standard. And that's kind of what everyone thinks they have to do in order to get strong with squats.
Correct.
You know, I'm a huge fan of box squats, so you can go the other end of that spectrum. You know, I am a believer in box squats.
To parallel, right?
Yeah, absolutely. To parallel. Absolutely. It feels great on your hips. I think for longevity, it's fantastic.
Yep.
You can load them. You can even, you know, God knows everyone's like front loading. Ooh, but you could actually practice front loading a box squat. It's a great place to practice that.
I love front loaded box squats. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm not a huge proponent of that. I think it's one of those myths or those story things that have been over time, right?
The industry the fitness industry runs on a pendulum of extremes, right? Everything is either good or bad, or right or wrong, healthy or unhealthy, mm-hmm. better or worse. And it's not as black and white as that, right? And for whatever it's worth, I think the people who say ass to grass squats are inherently better, they're the same type of people who say fasted cardio is inherently better for fat loss. It's like, no, it's not inherently better. It's very much dependent on the individual. And the reality is we have to look at the risk versus the reward. So for some people, actually, before we even get into this, we have to realize everyone's hip structure looks differently.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
If you look at actual people's real bone structure of their hip, you're going to realize not only do every individual person, like they have different hip structure than another person, but oftentimes your two hips will differ, mm-hmm. right? So you could have one hip is going to be different than the other hip. So maybe going down might feel good on one side, but on the other side, it's always pinching. And if you're always trying to force yourself down into an ass to grass squat, but it's pinching and it doesn't feel good, it's pulling on your lower back, you're jamming bone on bone contact. Mm-hmm. You're going to hurt your lower back. Yep. You're going to hurt your hips. You're going to end up getting surgery at some point. So, I mean, for that person, it's a no-brainer. Ass to grass squats are not only not better, they're significantly worse than taking something to parallel. I think having these black and white standards of you must go ass to grass does way more harm than good. Mm-hmm. What we should really be doing is finding what pain-free range of motion can you accomplish and use that as the standard rather than just saying, well, your ass has to touch the ground. That's, you're an idiot.
I think people, you know, especially with social media now, there's some sort of less than thing. You know, it's less than if you don't do what this person does.
Correct.
Or whatever. And I'm just all about finding what works for you. My hips are different from yours, different from, you know, we all are built differently. And so as much as I might ever want to do that, that ain't gonna happen.
Correct.
I mean, I'm working on that from a mobility perspective with nothing. I mean, just to get my hips down there a little bit. Little bit at a time. Not because I'm ever going to want to put weight on my back when I do it. God, no. No, yep. I'm doing it for a hip health thing. That's it.
And we could even go into the topic of people saying, like, if you don't back squat at all, it's like, it's the same type of argument. It's like, personally, I barely ever back squat. I almost exclusively Bulgarian split squat. I just, for me personally, they feel way better on my hips.
And
I hate doing them. Like, I hate Bulgarian split squats. They are just the worst, but also the best. But for me, I like doing them better than doing regular back squats. If I was going to do a back squat, I would probably do a box squat. I just think it's generally safer. It feels better. You can get a really good gauge for how deep you're going. There's no guess, right? So some people, they're like, well, I don't know how deep I'm going. And then they'll go too low and they'll hurt their hip. They'll hurt their back. And other people, they're like, well, I don't know how deep I'm going. And they barely move an inch. They like do like an eighth of a squat. So having the box there gauges your depth for you. You know every time you either touch the box or you didn't. Mm-hmm. I think also a lot of times it helps you control it better because you're not just going to drive right into the box. You're just going to drop down without any control. We were talking earlier about how some people with their push-ups, they'll just drop all the way down to the floor. Same thing with squats. You see a lot of people, they'll start going down under control and then just plop down to the bottom. Yeah. You want to go under control and sort of sitting down to a box in the same, like, ideally, when you're going to take a dump, you don't just drop down to the toilet and plop down, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with the squat. Slowly control yourself down to the box and come right back up. And I think, for me, I've worked with a lot of different varieties of population, different types of people. I can tell you without question, one of the populations of people who I would never have squat ass to grass or maybe even not even to parallel are basketball players. Mm-hmm. Like they're huge.
Yeah, they're so tall.
So we could just take out basketball player and put in tall people.
Yeah.
Like a really tall person, oftentimes squatting ass to grass or parallel is so dangerous and so completely and utterly ass backwards, it's going to do more harm than good. So again, the question is, instead of saying why aren't you squatting ass to grass? The question should be, why aren't you squatting in a range of motion that is pain-free and healthy?
For you.
You have to find what works best for you.
You know, that whole less than thing goes with chin-ups and pull-ups too, doesn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely,
I mean, I get asked all the time, why don't you do pull-ups? A, because I don't want to. B, because they hurt my shoulders like hell.
Yep.
And they don't understand that it's a different move.
They both have pros and cons.
They both do, yeah. And for me, that's just never going to happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I occasionally will do, and just for everyone, if you don't understand, a chin-up is when you're pulling yourself up with your palms facing your face, right? Mm-hmm. So chin-ups have your palms facing your face. A pull-up is generally, not always, but generally a slightly wider grip with your palms facing away from your face. And there are different pros and cons to each. So generally, both Susan and I prefer chin-ups over pull-ups. Pull-ups, they can be a little bit harder on the shoulder. Generally, the range of motion is smaller, so you get a little bit less muscle recruitment. And I think one of the other benefits of the chin-up, just to be frank, is you get more like bicep recruitment. So you get a little bit more arms as, in addition. If you really wanted to target your lats, I would say, okay, maybe you want to do some wider grip, just regular pull-up variations. But even then, if you're really that concerned about hitting your lats, you might as well do some lat pull-downs, because you'll probably hit your lats way better doing a lat pull-down than you will doing a pull-up, I think.
Yeah.
I think a pull-up is more a standard of strength, of like, can you actually lift your body in this way, as opposed to using it as an isolation exercise.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so this is going, this question, it was good, because I'm trying to also just talk more about mental health, so this is going a little bit different, but how do you know which therapist works for you?
That's a great question.
It's a really good question, yeah.
And I think, because we both have experience from this, I did therapy years ago. I mean, it's been a long time for me. And I remember some piece of advice that someone gave me back then. And as a counselor myself, I would see this all the time. And that is, you know, not everyone's going to be a great fit for each person, right? So
yep.
if you are getting therapy through your insurance or whatever, and maybe you're assigned a therapist, or you have a list to pick from and you really don't know these people or whatever, and you pick somebody, the thing I would say is, don't judge anything by one session. Don't be a one and done.
Yep.
Because I think the first session, there's always a little bit of awkward whatever, because you're getting to know each other.
Correct.
And I think it deserves more time, as does doing fat loss programs, doing anything like that, right?
Yes.
You have to give it time. That being said, you know, I would think after a handful of sessions, you will either start to get into a rhythm with a person or not. And you will feel that. And I've been on the end of, I didn't feel it. And I think maybe I went in, I don't know, I was with that person for a while, and I just never felt a connection of sorts. I felt like I was in checking the box, and I knew that wasn't the right way it should be.
Yeah.
So I changed, and I was worried. I was all worried about that person. I didn't want the person to feel upset. And what I learned is that this is very normal. It happens all the time. They know that.
Correct.
And a good therapist also knows that they are not the fit for every single person. They don't know if they're going to feel good with you either. I mean, it's kind of a get to know you, right?
Absolutely. Same thing with it's the same thing with coaches, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
You have clients all the time. It's mm-hmm. like, listen, after a certain point, maybe they don't need you anymore, or it's just not a good fit. Like, I would never be insulted if a client's like, listen, I just feel like I need a different coaching style.
Yeah,
like, it's super normal, and I would rather have that than have them pretend like it's working when it's not. In terms of probably the best advice I could give for finding the best therapist for you, it would probably be, make sure that you're not just looking for someone to agree with you,
mm-hmm.
right? I think a lot of people, they just want someone who's going to agree with them and say you're doing all the right things. And the reason I'm saying this is because, you know, I've seen a number of therapists throughout my life. More recent, like, I didn't see one for many, many years until just now, about 3 or 4 months ago. But when I was younger, in high school and just after high school, I saw a couple of therapists, and I remember one of the therapists that I saw, I got really mad because he would make me think, and he wouldn't just agree with me. And I would say, well, I think this and this. And then he'd be like, well, why do you feel like you're entitled to that? Make a question like that. And I would get angry. And I remember I stopped going to therapy as a result of that. And looking back, I think that was a huge mistake. And now the therapist that I have does the same type of thing. So he'll ask the same type of questions. And he won't just let me say what I say and then just be like, oh, yeah, you're right. He won't just agree with me. He'll challenge me on it and make me think about it. And like, well, if you think you were right here, well, why? Did you think about it from this perspective? It's like, I think that you could have done better. And in the same way that a coach will push you to be better, I think a therapist will do that too.
Because
mm-hmm. if you're just looking for someone to just say you're great as you are and everything you're doing is right, you're not looking for therapy. You're just looking for confirmation.
You're looking for a friend who will just sit there and listen.
Correct. That's it. And, and that's not what therapy is. A therapy... Part of it is having a sounding board for mm-hmm. you to just get your thoughts off your chest. But I think that at least the way that I've been able to use it has been trying to get better. And part of that is really not only just letting out what I have on the inside, but also trying, like, examining my thoughts, examining my emotions, and seeing where can I improve to get better.
And that's difficult emotionally. Yeah, it's hard. When you have to turn in to yourself, that's super hard and uncomfortable. There's that uncomfortable word again.
Yes.
You know, and that's what a therapist needs to do, yeah, for sure.
I agree. Okay, next question, back to strength training. So the way they worded this question was funny. We'll rephrase it after I read it. They wrote, grip strength thingy. I don't know the exact name of those. Are they worth it? So there are many different types of tools that are sold on the fitness market. Sort of just feel like the fitness market, like the black market. It's on the fit in the fitness industry. There are many grip strength tools. The first one that comes to mind is fat grips, mm-hmm. which are these like really thick blue things that you can attach to any dumbbell handle, barbell handle. You could attach it to a pull-up bar. And I'll start just by saying I'm not the biggest fan of those. I don't think they're worthless, but especially, for example, fat grips for pull-ups and chin-ups, generally speaking, most people don't need to make a pull-up or a chin-up harder, especially from a grip strength perspective, from making the grip wider. If you're making the grip more narrow, I think now we're actually going to be getting into some useful discussion and have some useful properties to it. But generally speaking, a fat grips, it's like it makes your hand really, really wide. You can't even get your whole hand around it. And just for me personally, thinking about life in general, I don't feel like that crops up very often. And if I'm doing a chin-up or a pull-up or a row, for example, my goal with a chin-up or a pull-up or a row isn't to work my grip. It's mm-hmm. to work my back, mm-hmm. right? So sort of the same thing when people like they do bench presses, and at the same time as they're bench pressing, they're doing flutter kicks with their legs to work their abs. What are you doing? Yeah. The purpose of a bench press isn't to work your abs. The purpose of a bench press is to increase your bench press strength and to increase your chest and your shoulders and your tricep strength.
Yep.
So for me, I'm not the biggest fan of something like fat grips for increasing your grip strength, because generally speaking, if you're doing it with a row or a chin-up or a pull-up or whatever, or a bicep curl, the purpose for that isn't your grip strength. The purpose is to, if you're doing a bicep curl, to grow your biceps. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a row, to strengthen your back. If you want to do your grips, if you want to work on your grip strength, then you should do things specifically for your grip strength. So for example, I would say farmer's walks. Farmer's walks just improve your grip strength. If you want to do a dead hang from a pull-up bar for a minute straight, that's going to improve your grip strength. Deadlifts, mm-hmm. that improves your grip strength. Mm-hmm. If you want, one of the things that I was my favorite thing to do is, if I was doing 3 sets of 5 deadlifts, then the last rep of every set, on the 5th rep of every set, I would hold that for 10, 15, or 20 seconds. And then just, that was another way to just challenge my grip strength. But I wouldn't do it with a fat grip because I didn't think that was necessary. I thought it was more or less a waste of time. But on the other hand, one thing I've been doing, especially for jiu-jitsu, is in jiu-jitsu, you hold on to the other person's uniform, their gi, right? And so that grip is very thin, right? And you use a lot more finger strength. Mm-hmm. You don't use as much hand strength. So if you think about grip strength for a deadlift, why would you try and improve your grip strength for a deadlift with a fat grip when the deadlift is using a bar that's really thin?
Right.
Why would I try to improve my grip strength for jiu-jitsu when I hold on to someone's thin gi with a fat type implement? It doesn't make sense.
No.
So generally speaking, for example, rock climbers. Rock climbers arguably have the strongest grip strength of anyone in any sport, right? And their fingers are really where they get all the strength from. It's not because they're holding on to anything really fat. It's because they're gripping with their fingers on these tiny little rocks, these tiny little cliffs, and they hold there for a long period of time. So if I'm going to do something for my grip, I'm going to use maybe like a towel grip or a gi grip, something like that, to really challenge my finger strength.
Yeah, I would say I've never used any of those things. So I can't speak from experience in any way, shape, or form. But what I can say is that I've worked on grip strength from carries, and I like bottoms up carries too. Bottoms up kettlebell carries really make you work on your grip too. I've done hangs, farmer's carries really are kind of it for me, and then towel grips. Do towel grip rows, towel grip inverted rows. Maybe one day I'll try a towel grip chin up. I probably could get a couple, but I mean, they're so hard.
Yeah.
And it is a finger strength, so it makes sense. You know, and I'll say this, years ago, before we started working together, I would use straps when I deadlifted a couple times.
Yep.
And that helped, because I probably couldn't have gotten the bar up probably at that time with what I was moving at that time. But I have not, I haven't used them in 10 years, I don't know, 8 years, something like that. I just haven't needed to because of all the other things.
Makes total sense. All right, this is a good one going into the, from the last question. What are the best stretches that you should be doing before deadlifting?
You know, that's interesting. I don't know what this person is thinking of when they use the word stretch. Because a lot of people, when they say the word stretch, they think sit down and you're like statically sitting there with your legs doing this, that, whatever. There's active stretching too, which is kind of more in the ballpark that I go in. And I focus on my glutes as much as anything else, like before deadlifting. Even from a mobility perspective, I focus on them that way. And it's more active for me. So I'm not going to sit there on the floor, you know, in a stretch when my body's cold. I hate that feeling. I want to make sure my body's warmed up before I do anything static, which usually happens more afterwards or in between sets or something like that when I'm kind of more warm. But I will do like banded lateral walks or something like that. That's not technically a stretch.
Correct.
But it's warming up my glutes. It's getting them on fire a little bit. I'm feeling them, getting the blood flowing. So I kind of do stuff like that. It seems to work really well.
Yeah. I love that. I think it depends on, number one, you as an individual, like what you need to work on if with your own mobility issues and also your own stability issues. I think a lot of people, they only look at mobility and they neglect to look at stability, and they neglect to look at how stability can improve mobility. So I'll also say it'll depend on the type of deadlift you're doing. So for example, if you're going to go into a sumo deadlift, I would say it would be worthwhile to do some mobilizations for your adductors before you go into that, right? Because you could strain your adductor. Now, if you're working with a very, like a hyper flexible individual, man or woman, doesn't matter, they probably don't need to do these adductor mobilizations because they're hyper flexible, but they absolutely do need to do glute bridges beforehand to really make sure, because they're hyper flexible, right? So they don't have as much stability, they don't have as much control over their body. So maybe they would end up using, they would be relying on passive structures, their ligaments and tendons and joints, as opposed to using their glutes to actually generate the movement. So I'll give some examples just right off the bat. And for Inner Circle members, we have videos for every single one of these exercises in the database of the Inner Circle. I would say split stance adductor mobilizations would be a really important one to do before you deadlift, sumo or conventional. I would say T-spine extensions, bench T-spine extensions. This is really important. You see a lot of people, they really struggle to get in the bottom position of a deadlift, sumo or conventional, especially conventional, but sometimes sumo as well, depending on their own mobility issues. But T-spine is just your upper back, right? So a lot of people, this rounded upper back when they're trying to get in the bottom position of the deadlift. So you want to mobilize that. I would say a T-spine extension and or a T-spine extension slash rotation. Again, Inner Circle members, videos for all of these in the database in your members portal. So those would be the mobilization exercises I would do. Maybe even some wall slides, some seated scapular wall slides.
It's so funny. Those three in that order.
Yeah.
Before every workout, upper, lower, every single one.
I think it's everyone should have those included in their workout. It's just super, super important. And then from there, I would do some type of glute bridge, right? Glute bridge, single leg glute bridge, hip thrust, just body weight. No need to lift weight, just like to do quote unquote activation. And then from there, I would do something for your abs. Could be a 20-second plank, just something just to really get it firing. And then you're good to go. Then you go to your deadlifts, and then you're good to go.
Absolutely.
Okay. Last question, Susan. How do you brace your core? It's a good question.
That is, because I think a lot of people think you brace your core by sucking in your stomach.
I'm so glad you said that, because that is the most common myth
that I see around it. That is.
And I see a lot of these TikTokers saying, like, brace your core, brace your core. And then they show themselves doing a stomach vacuum. And I'm like, that's, what are you talking about?
Yeah, that's not bracing your core at all. No, I guess the best way to look at it is if you take a big belly breath where you actually see your belly come out And any musician knows how to do this, because this is how you play an instrument, this is how you sing and get a decent sound, is you're able to take a nice deep belly breath and expand your diaphragm. And when it's out in that position, which so many people hate the look of, and that's correct. Part of the that's driving force,
mentally,
right?
Yeah, mentally, it's a big issue.
Because you look at your stomach, you're going, ah, you know, you don't want
to. I don't want people to think I'm fat.
I don't want to think I'm fat, so right? So they suck it in. Yeah, but you want it there. And then you want to hold it. And there's a lot of ways to think about that. I'll let you tell your way. But I like to say, you know, pretend like somebody's going to punch you in the gut, which can go in inside. But if you really stop and think about it, if you're laying on the ground, and this is probably a better way to do that, if you're laying on the ground and someone's about ready to pound you, you're probably not going to go in. You're probably going to bear down. And that kind of leads to yours.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, think about it like this. I know a lot of people listen to podcasts either when they're driving or when they're on a walk. Not as much when you're sitting down. When you're driving, obviously, you're sitting down. Either way, take a moment to really maybe lie down, sit down, and think about this. And number one, just relax. Just try and be as relaxed as you can. And think about how you're feeling when you're sitting on the toilet dropping a dookie. All right? That's the scientific term for it.
It is.
So it's not a good morning, right? You're a little bit backed up. You can feel you've got to drop a dookie, but like it's not just sliding out like a really good one. I'm getting graphic here, but it's making the story better, all right? Like we all know the really good ones where they just come right out. You barely got a wipe. It's just like, oh, sweet. This is a clean one. Good to go. The worst ones are like that. They struggle to get it out. And you're just sitting there, and you got everywhere. The veins coming through your forehead because you're pushing. And it's like, I want you to think about that. I want you to think about sitting on the toilet and you're squeezing. You're trying to push it. Like you're just like squeezing.
That's the bear
and
down.
Number one, when you do that, notice what happens with your belly. It comes out. When you squeeze, your belly will literally pop out, right? And that's the exact same thing. You're going to feel the belly coming out because you're creating intra-abdominal pressure. Number two is oftentimes your tongue will go to the roof of your mouth. This is called the Valsalva maneuver in weightlifting, where you shove your tongue to the roof of your mouth and you don't let air escape. Now, this is not something to do if you have high blood pressure, but if you don't have high blood pressure and you're healthy, like that's totally fine. This is, by the way, how Elvis died, right? On the toilet. He died on the toilet trying to take a poop because he was doing the Valsalva maneuver, trying to just squirt one out.
Oh my goodness.
And then it really went really high. His blood pressure went really high. That's at least the story that I know. Either way, think about trying to squeeze one out and you're going to notice your abs start to get really, really tight. And that's number one, what you'd want it to be like if someone was going to punch you in the stomach. And number two, that's how you brace your core when you squeeze. Now, the better you get at it, you don't need to shove your tongue on the roof of your mouth. You don't need to hold your breath. When you're learning it, holding your breath can help. It can help just learn how to actually brace your core. As you get better, I think it's actually beneficial to learn how to do that while breathing, while continuing to breathe in and out. But sometimes people, it's hard to sort of differentiate between their lungs and their diaphragm at the beginning, because your diaphragm is really what's expanding here. But a lot of times and that's why musicians, it's so easy for them, because you're really good at expanding your diaphragm. What you want to do is take a big breath in, relax, and try and squeeze, try like you're squeezing out a dookie, but don't actually poop, right? You don't want that to actually happen on the gym floor. And ask any powerlifter. Any competitive powerlifter will have either done it themselves or seen someone else poop themselves in training. Like raising my hand, I've done it and I've seen it. I have some really funny stories about that I could tell you about in another podcast. But that's how you brace your core. You take a big breath in, try and imagine squeezing out a dookie, but don't actually squeeze out the dookie, and you're going to feel your abs getting nice and tight. And then you replicate that in the gym while you're squatting or deadlifting or bench pressing or
just
doing
about
push-ups.
Anything.
Yeah, literally anything.
Yeah.
And again, it's not to the point where you should be like, you shouldn't like be having trouble seeing you're squeezing so hard. You do want to get to the point where you can continuously breathe throughout that brace. But I think starting with holding your breath at least for a couple of seconds at a time can help.
Absolutely.
So this was a good one.
This is great.
A lot of dookie talk at the
end. A lot
end,
of dookie talk.
This is good. Do you want to remind everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, just Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Susan Niebergall Fitness. It's NIE, by the way. NIEBERGALL.
Yeah, that's great. Definitely give Susan a follow. And if you'd like to join the Inner Circle, you can do that at www.sfinnercircle.com. Again, this is the 5th year anniversary coming up in December. We are very, very
super excited.
We would love to have you in there. Have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you soon. That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. They've been incredibly helpful, and we're actually almost at 1,000 total reviews. So if you haven't done that yet, it would really mean the world to me. Have a wonderful day. I'll talk to you next time.